Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
And welcome to Pole Position, the motorsports show here on Rock Sport Radio. Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd. We're broadcasting live on DAB Digital Radio across Central Scotland, online and on TuneIn. So on the show this week, Silverstone Race keeps its calendar place. Is the title fight done with Marquez winning for fun? And big stars travel to Rally Estonia's gravel. All this and more on Pole Position. Now, Formula One returns this weekend, with the action heading to Silverstone for the British Grand Prix. Mercedes driver Lewis Hamilton leads the way at the top of the Drivers' Championship on 197 points, 31 clear of his teammate Valtteri Bottas, with Red Bull's Max Verstappen now in third place on 126 points. Adam, Max Verstappen will be going into this one full of confidence, of course, after winning last time out in Austria.
He sure will, Max Verstappen. This time last year, there were still questions being asked about him. Of course, he had those six incidents in six races, and people were really talking about Max Verstappen, saying, did they promote him to Red Bull too early? But fast forward a year, you know, people are saying he's been the best driver so far this season. That's certainly something I would agree with. He was fantastic in Austria. The way he charged down Valtteri Bottas, Charles Leclerc after that dreadful start, one of the best drives I've ever witnessed in Formula One.
But Adam, how important is this race going to be for Ferrari now? Because Sebastian Vettel now fourth in the standings.
Yeah, and I think that sums up Ferrari's season, really. You'd still say Ferrari are the second best team in Formula One, yet both of their drivers aren't third in the standings, and it's the Red Bull Honda of Max Verstappen. And let's not forget now, Honda wins one, Ferrari zilch. So that will not be going down well at all. So they're really under pressure to get a win this season. They've had chances as well, you know. This has not been as one-sided as some people may have thought. You know, should have won in Bahrain, had a chance in Azerbaijan. We saw in Canada they were quick. And again in Austria, you know, Ferrari could have had four race wins this season, but they've simply not did right when it came down to the big decisions. It's going to be another tough weekend though for Ferrari, because you just feel with Ferrari, you know, they need everything to go right for them and they need a bit of luck, whereas Mercedes are just so strong at the moment, they're not making any mistakes. Although, as we saw in Austria, anything's possible.
Absolutely. Now, one of the big stories going into this event is the news that Silverstone will continue to host the British Grand Prix for the next five seasons. So how important is this deal for the sport? Well, joining us on Pole Position to talk more about this, I'm delighted to welcome back Stuart Codling from F1 Racing. Stuart, what's your initial reaction to this announcement?
This is absolutely fabulous news. Not just that we've got the British Grand Prix back at Silverstone for another 5 years, but also that they've managed to somehow remap the commercial territory so that they can actually make a little bit of money out of it and make Silverstone a sustainable destination. And the whole reason for triggering the break clause a couple of years ago was that they'd crunched the numbers and realised that by 2023 or whatever, they'd just be making an irretrievable loss.
And Stuart, how important is it for Formula One to stay at Silverstone in particular?
Well, Silverstone is where the first World Championship Grand Prix was held back when, you know, England had a king, well, the United Kingdom had a king, and the Queen Mother, as she later became, apparently was startled by the noise of the car setting off and dropped her handkerchief or something, as the colour commentators of the day observed. So it's kind of where the Formula One World Championship began. Britain was still rationing petrol at the time. That's how long ago it was. So it's all tied into the history of things. But also, I think these historic venues do have a value to the sport, because there's a fan base here. I'm speaking to you. You can probably hear the traffic in the background. I'm speaking to you from outside Whittlebury Hall, which is where the drivers stay. I've just seen Romain Grosjean checking in here. There's tens of thousands of people camping here. And it's not a new venue in a new territory where they have to spend years and years growing the audience. Yeah, the audience is here, and it's a sellout, and people want to come here and watch Formula One.
And Stuart, with all that in mind, that leads me quite nicely to the talk that there's been recently about having a London race as well. Do you think there's ever been any mileage in that?
Some people do, some people don't. A few years ago, when I was a freelancer, I was involved in Santander drew up this sort of fantasy scheme for what a London Grand Prix might look like. So they drew up a layout around the city centre. I dare say if you look on YouTube, you'll be able to see the video that they made with Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton, who were then the Santander-backed McLaren-Mercedes drivers. And it seems plausible, but I'm sure, you know, you'd have to shave a lot of the roads. There's drain covers. There's businesses who'd want to be compensated for having to shut down. And where else in London would you do it? Would you do it in Docklands? Formula E are doing a sort of a street circuit near XL. But, you know, if you've ever been in that sort of part of London, there's not really that much there. It's tricky to get to. The road layout isn't very interesting. So I think you kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place, really, where you have an interesting layout that's right in the heart of the city, but is really inconvenient and expensive and divisive and difficult to manage from a safety point of view, or a place that is kind of a bit boring and not really London. So I can't really see anyone stepping forward to make it happen.
Hi, Stuart. Adam here. Liberty Media, they've been in charge for a while now. How would you assess their governance of the sport so far?
I think they're doing all right. I think they've probably found it a little bit more difficult than they expected. And to my mind, this sort of being friendly with everyone tactic that they've been employing isn't really working, particularly with regard to the next step, which is the 2021 rules. Formula One's due a major remapping. The commercial settlement that everyone lives by is coming to an end in 2020. They've got to organise a new commercial settlement. They've got to organise a new rules package. And at the moment, because Liberty are being kind of chums with everyone, it's kind of given people who shouldn't really have that much of a say, too much of a say. So you've got teams sticking their oar in with the commercial settlement, particularly the big manufacturers like Mercedes and Ferrari. And I think that Formula One teams, the sport should operate by the maxim of Victorian dad, which is that children should be seen and not heard. So maybe have a little bit of consultation with the teams, but not let them run the show to the extent that they are.
And the sport is being run quite a different style now. There's a few things that spring to mind, I suppose, that perhaps wouldn't happen in Bernie's watch. Is that a good thing that there is now different owners and a different style?
Yeah, it's run as a business, whereas before you had the sort of what one might occasionally call a benevolent dictatorship model under Bernie Ecclestone. But don't forget that for the last 10 years of his reign, the people really calling the shots were venture capitalists who were just draining money out of the business like there was no tomorrow. And all these sort of weird and wonderful Grand Prix destinations we've gone to that have come and gone, like Korea and India, all these white elephant circuits that have been, you know, had government money lavished upon them, used for a couple of years and then go into disrepair. All that has come through this sort of chase for money at all costs, the big wins. And really, I'm kind of hoping that Liberty are pursuing a more organic business model of growth and looking at new stuff that Bernie probably wasn't quite so interested in. You remember that quote he said, you know, I'm not interested in people who can't afford a Rolex. I think, you know, that there's money out there. You just don't always have to be chasing the large apples. There's smaller fruit on the tree that's still within reach for picking.
Stuart, you mentioned the next set of regulations that we've got kind of looming on the horizon here. How crucial is it for Liberty that they get them right?
It's absolutely crucial that they get them right, because if you look at the scenario we have now, where, once again, it's kind of come about through too many people having input into it. We have a situation where, yes, the cars are fast, they're wide, they look great, but the strategies are all very convergent. We're all locked into a one-stop race. You have one team, Mercedes, that has fantastic resources, is brilliantly well-drilled. So naturally, it always comes out on top. So the onus is on the sports stakeholders to come up with a set of rules that isn't dependent on how much money and resource you throw at it. Because one of the problems that, for instance, Haas has, the smaller American team, is that when they have a problem, you know, they're struggling to understand their tyres, they don't have hundreds of people and hours of simulation resources to throw at understanding that problem and crunching all the data. So the net result is that they go backwards and they can't unlock the speed in the car. And what we really need is a scenario where the people who've been clever, who've developed quick cars that can show a real turn of pace like Kevin Magnussen did in qualifying for Austria, can roll that performance onto race day and really be impressive. But at the moment, kind of the ground rules of Formula One aren't really working in that way.
Stuart, do you think because there's been such a big gap between the current hybrid era set of regulations and proposed new ones that we've got in the coming years, do you think because we've had such a big gap like that, that has been a bit of a negative for Formula One? You know, there's not been opportunities for teams to go and continually develop with car. What we're seeing is this environment where Mercedes have really just got a monopoly over everyone else in terms of performance.
I think there's a lot to be said for Formula One not really doing a good job of selling the virtues of the hybrid technology. You know, these engines are fantastically efficient in terms of the way they burn the fuel. So that is a good story that the sport isn't telling. But at the same time, I think what we're coming to realise is that efficiency has come at a massive cost. So Mercedes have got it right. All the tricky things, the energy recovery from heat is a very tricky thing to manage. And certainly the e-turbos, which was the holy grail of this generation of engine, which is the business of you recover energy from heat and you use that to spin the turbo. So you get rid of that whole problem turbos have always had, which is that they take time to spin up and deliver their power boost. That was supposed to be a transformative technology for road cars. And what's been discovered is it's fantastically difficult and expensive to implement. Can you look at the road car market and see any cars like that? No, there is only one car out there that has the full suite of Formula One technologies, and that's the Infiniti Project Black S, which is still a concept car at the moment and a prototype. And the reason for that is it's really, really difficult and expensive to implement that technology. So it will be interesting to see if that rolls through into the next generation of Formula One rules. There's a lot of people who actually quite like to get rid of e-turbos for that reason.
And Stuart, looking ahead to this weekend, Silverstone, always a great track. The drivers, the fans love it, as you mentioned at the top of the show. Lewis Hamilton going for a record 6th win. Do you see Ferrari or Red Bull challenging Lewis Hamilton for the victory? And can Valtteri Bottas step up and take the fight to his teammate this weekend?
Well, I think for the good of the championship, we certainly need Valtteri to step up. I'm not too confident about Red Bull. I don't think that the Honda engine has the full power available to it. They're looking to implement a better party mode, as they call it, which gives them more power in qualifying. But I think over the course of a race and at a track like Silverstone, Honda might struggle a little bit. Ferrari are already playing down expectations of what they'll achieve here, which is disappointing considering they won here 12 months ago. So, if I were a betting man, I would say Lewis Hamilton is highly likely to be the winner here. It won't be a good bet because he's the favourite. But for the good of the championship, let's hope that Valtteri Bottas can find something and overturn Lewis's advantage. But, you look back to the Austrian Grand Prix, Valtteri had been fastest in practice and all the way through qualifying, and then just at the vital moment in Q3, Lewis found something and beat him. Valtteri just had his head in his hands afterwards, as if to say, what can I do to beat this man? I've thrown everything I can at this, and he's still faster. At the moment, Lewis Hamilton really is a winning machine.
And Stuart, just finally, you mentioned Romain Grosjean there. He could really do with a strong result this weekend.
Yeah, Haas really need a strong result. They've been having trouble with their tyres and also trouble with the CEO of their sponsors, as you've probably noticed on social media. The William Story's kind of gone rogue, and he's been tweeting. It's all gone a little bit Jeremy Kyle on Twitter. And from our understanding, the various financial backers of the Rich Energy Project are looking to kick him into the long grass because, as he has manifestly proved, he's a bit of a nutter and a loose cannon. It's not a problem for the team because the sponsorship is guaranteed by the bank, so they are going to get their money regardless of what happens with this ridiculous sort of sideshow that's going on social media. But it is a little bit destabilising, and really for a team in this position that's developed a car that's quick but somehow isn't capable of unlocking that pace over the course of a race without sort of shredding its tyres. I think they need to find something, but it's going to be very difficult. And as you say, it's a very, very peculiar situation.
Absolutely. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us on the show. But always really grateful for the time you give us here on Pole Position.
Thank you.
That's Stuart Codling from F1 Racing there. And stay with us as we talk more motorsport up next on Rock Sport Radio.
Do you hear that? That's your family coming round to your new house for Sunday lunch. Your son opening the door of his first home. Visitors arriving at your guest house. Friends coming over to watch the football. Scottish Building Society offer a range of mortgages, so we can turn this into this.
Love!
Scottish Building Society. We've been helping people open doors since 1848. Call us today on 0345 600 4085. Scottish Building Society is authorised by the Prudential Regulation Authority and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority and the Prudential Regulation Authority.
The list of things you need to do gets longer at this time of year, whether that's for the house or in your business. So tick one thing off your list right now. Your septic tank could need emptied. Let Grant Henderson Tankers empty your septic tank in the home or work, farm, factory or workshop at very competitive rates. We are septic tank specialists, experienced, safe and dedicated to environmental safety with our own licensed disposal site. Find out more at wemovesh.it or call 01698 284 987. Grant Henderson Tankers. Let the experts manage your waste.
Motorpoint, we put the super into car supermarket. We're here to save the day with a choice of over 7,000 low-mileage, nearly new cars. Find your next car in a flash with our lightning-fast service and same-day drive-away. Plus, with Motorpoint's price pledge, if you find the same car for less, we'll match the price and give you a £50 Amazon voucher. Visit Motorpoint Glasgow today, just 2 minutes from Junction 3 of the M74. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
Have you ever bought an investment sold by Barclays, Halifax, Lloyds, Santander or any other bank or financial advisor? Investments like stocks and shares ISAs, investment bonds and certain types of pension can be risky. If you lost money with one of these investments, you could be owed thousands of pounds in compensation. Even if you no longer have the investment or the paperwork, here at Goodwin Barrett, we can still help. To start your free assessment with Goodwin Barrett, text GOOD to 66777. That's GOOD to 66777.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
MotoGP now, and Marc Marquez won his fifth race of the season at the German Grand Prix last weekend. He extended his gap at the top of the standings to 58 points. Yamaha's Maverick Viñales was second, while Britain's Cal Crutchlow took the final step on the podium. And Adam, another absolute masterclass. How many times do we say that about Marc Marquez?
Yeah, he's just been sensational this season. And in Germany, he's just completely dominant. That was his 10th victory that he's taken from pole position in Germany across all classes. I mean, he's unbeaten. It's just a sensational record. I mean, imagine taking 10 pole positions and 10 race victories at the same track across 10 years, you know. A record that's not been achieved before in MotoGP. So he's just incredible, goes so well at this track. And you're right, another masterclass from Marquez. He's been so dominant at Texas, which was the third race of the season this year, and everybody was saying, oh, Marquez is going to run away with it. And what happened? He crashed out while leading. So I think there was always a part of us that probably for the first time in Germany were perhaps thinking, maybe even though he's got this big lead, it's not over until it's over.
And Adam, two retirements on the bounce for Suzuki's Alex Rins. So, I mean, maybe that's him now fourth in the rider standings on 101 points. Maybe any chances of him mounting a real threat to Marquez are in doubt?
Yeah, it was always going to be Honda versus Ducati this season, but Alex Rins really surprised many people at the start of this season with some strong performances, got the victory at Texas. The Suzuki really does lack top-line speed, but even at places like Mugello, he still finished fourth and was still able to take the fight to the two Ducatis and Marquez, which was so impressive. And that's perhaps when people thought, you know, perhaps it's not impossible for Suzuki to mount a fight. Yes, it's not the strongest bike at the moment, But Alex Rins is doing such a good job. But, you know, you can't really afford two retirements when you're up against Marc Márquez. And for the two Ducatis as well, disastrous for them. You know, I don't know where their pace has gone. Fifth and fourth, both off the podium. You know, they've not had a podium since Catalunya, and that was Danilo Petrucci. So it's been a miserable time for Ducati recently. And championship for Dovi, Petrucci, Rins, all done. And I think it's fair to say that Márquez, you know, does have it wrapped up. You know, you cannot see anyone challenging Márquez for the championship. They're just too far behind. It's as simple as that.
No, but Adam, with that being said, the one thing that really interests me about MotoGP in comparison to Formula 1 is the narrative surrounding the championship battle. Because if you look at MotoGP, Marc Márquez, is he going to win the championship? Yes, let's be honest, right? It's a done deal. However, we're not all sitting after the races going, oh my God, that's just Márquez, this is getting really dull, this is getting very, very tiresome. The action is still very, very good. When you look at Formula 1 in comparison, Mercedes, of course, so dominant. The conversation's quite different. Oh, it's all Lewis Hamilton. How, you know, how many seconds is he going to win by this weekend? You know, there's a very different attitude around the sport. And for me, that is what makes MotoGP still very entertaining, the fact that, yes, there's perhaps one rider who is a class above and certainly has been for the last few years, but everyone behind them, the action has been fantastic. You know, the last 10 laps of the race, it was focusing on that battle. Vinales and Cal Crutchlow, of course, taking the final step of the podium. There was some great scraps there, even further back as well. We weren't looking at Marc Márquez riding around in style and just, you know, bringing the bike home and seeing things out. There was some fantastic stuff to watch.
Definitely, and this is the great thing about MotoGP. Márquez is dominant at the moment, and of course we would like it to be more exciting and for us to really have a tight riders' championship, but Márquez has won 5 out of the 9 races so far this season. He's been sensational, but we've still had 4 different manufacturers win races this year. You know, you've had Yamaha, Maverick Vinales win, Alex Rins in the Suzuki win, and Danilo Petrucci, Andrea Dovizioso, they both won on the Ducati. So we've had Honda, Ducati, Suzuki, Yamaha all winning races this season. And you've also got a nice mix of youth with Fabio Quartararo. He's doing a terrific job. You know, he's getting a few podiums. Cal Crutchlow, as you mentioned. So it's not just the factory bikes that are getting podiums. This is what does make MotoGP exciting. It's just a shame, though, at that front, that we couldn't see that excitement at the championship battle, because at the end of the day, you know, that is what excites the fans. You know, it is a bit frustrating to know that really Marc Márquez, you know, unless something major happens, you know, as we said, the championship is wrapped up. So we would like more people to take the fight to him. But at the moment, he does have it easy in terms of consistency, and that's a problem, because Suzuki will maybe do well at one track, Ducati are suited to another, whereas Márquez is just suited to everything. The Honda's not suited to everything, you know, that's not a fantastic bike from what a lot of people say, but Márquez just makes it work.
You mentioned a lot of the young riders there, Adam. What about one of the more experienced guys on the grid, Valentino Rossi? 8th place finish, his first actual finish in 4 races, which is incredible in itself. Lots of people are suggesting that as time's wearing on here, Rossi isn't the same rider as he was when he was so dominant, and you know, if he's just happy chipping away and getting a good result here and there, then fair enough. But what's your take on the whole situation? Because, you know, he starts the season 5th in Qatar, then he gets 2 second place finishes in Argentina and at Texas. So you're kind of thinking, well, we could be in here, you know, we could be seeing a return to form for Rossi, but just not quite happening for him.
No, definitely not, and it is a real shame. After the race on Sunday, you know, he was complaining about the tyres, basically, and he was sliding all over the place. So he's really struggling at the moment, and especially when you look at the form of his teammate Maverick Vinales, who won in Assen, 2nd in Germany. And Maverick Vinales has the exact same result as Marc Márquez over the past 2 races. So Vinales is the man in form. He's level in points with Marc Márquez if you take the last 2 races. So Vinales has suddenly found form, because he was the Yamaha that was struggling. No one was really necessarily talking about Rossi, because he was ahead of Vinales in the championship. And as you mentioned, had that decent start to the season, 2 second places in the opening 3 races. Not had the podium since then. I mean, 3 retirements in a row. The pressure he must have felt in Germany to get a finish. And, you know, part of me thinks perhaps there's a bit of relief there for him to just finish, albeit 8th, which is nowhere near where he should be. The Yamaha, you know, there is issues on that bike at the moment. They're trying to resolve it. And, you know, it just seems to be a difficult year, and he's doesn't have a great feeling with the bike, and it's so difficult as a rider. You need to have a great feeling with the bike, because at the end of the day, you're going so fast, you know, it is dangerous. Of course, the riders don't think about the dangers when they're actually racing, but if you don't have a good feeling with the bike, you know, you're going to be a bit more cautious. Mm-hmm. And at this top level of racing, you cannot afford to be cautious. And the Yamaha bike for a few years now just hasn't been giving Rossi the tools that he needs to fight for a championship, because we know he can.
Absolutely. I mean, the last time he had three retirements on the bounce was the tail end of the 2011 season. But of course, the last time he actually took a win was Assen back in 2017. Since then, just 9 podium visits, Adam. So, I mean, it's not as if this has been a quick, arguably a quick decline for Rossi. There has been a gradual process here where we're not quite seeing the performances that we were so used to him getting in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, when you say that stat, you know, about I'm not winning, you know, that's more than 2 years, and for a guy of Valentino Rossi's calibre, it does seem unreal. I mean, he came so close to winning the championship when he was fighting against his Yamaha teammate Jorge Lorenzo a few years ago. And people were saying, oh, is this the moment where he gets that 10th championship across all classes? But Lorenzo pipped him to the post there. And since then, you know, he's just not been on a bike that's been capable of fighting for a championship or even fighting for a few race wins. So Rossi's struggling. It's not nice to see. And hopefully, after the summer break, we'll see a stronger, competitive Rossi and get some few podiums.
Now, a new museum celebrating the life and achievements of Scotland's two-time Formula One world champion Jim Clark opened its doors to the public earlier today. The £1.6 million partnership project is based in Dunn's, and it's a privilege and a pleasure to welcome Doug Niven, who's the cousin of Jim Clark and a trustee of the Jim Clark Trust, to the show. Doug, thanks very much for joining us. This must have been a very special day for you.
Well, it was, actually. The weather wasn't very kind this morning, but the doors opened at 10 o'clock, and by lunchtime there'd been, we reckon, over 300 people through the door, and so it was a great start to the programme. But, you know, we go back 7 years since the council decided that they would like to spend some more money, and then since then it's been a chase to raise the £1.65 million, and until we got that money in the bank, we weren't allowed to start the project. And the old museum has been closed for 15 months, so it's been a long time shut. And so today it was great to finally open the doors. And you know, when the public came in to see what was there, there was a Formula One car that Jim Clark raced 10 times. He'd won 4 Grand Prix between 1963 and 65, and he won his 2 world championships. And there was a Lotus Cortina that he won the 1964 British Touring Car Championship. And that car was kindly loaned by Dario Franchitti, who owns the car now.
Doug, just take us back to 7 years ago that you say there, where the idea kind of first came about and plans were taking shape. Because this has been quite a long journey to get us to this point here today.
Well, it has. Because, you know, It's some, you know, the 50-odd years since the museum has been opened. In 1969 is when it opened, actually. And then it was refurbed in 1993. So Jackie Stewart opened it then, and again. And, of course, you know, in the last 6 years, getting the plans and then the budgets together and bringing it all together, we're lucky to have some very good patrons, including Sir Jackie Stewart, who's our own president, along with Laura March from Goodwood, who's been very supportive, and quite a few other sort of luminaries like Dario Franchitti. We've got Hugh McKagan, who's a patron of Vicuria Cos, Andy Cowan, Ian Scott Watson, and David Coulthard, and one or two others, Alan McNish. So we're lucky to have these patrons who can open doors for us, you know, to help the Jim Clark Trust raise the money. But when the council offered to get the museum up and running again, they put in $600,000. We had Heritage Lottery funding, which was match funding, so that got us to $1.2 million. And then the council said that the Jim Clark Trust had to find the $300,000, and we did some crowdfunding. We also bought a Lotus Evora, a special edition one called the Clark Edition, which is chassis number 100,000 and is worth $110,000, and we've been selling tickets for that for the last year and a half or so, and that's been going very well, and that's helped us to raise quite a lot of money. We had it in Monaco, where all 20 drivers at the Grand Prix signed the tailgate of the car, and that will be going with the car. It's currently, the car is down at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. It was down at Goodwood the weekend before, and then it'll be back up here after that. So a lot going on, but it's been, you know, a long road, but we finally achieved it.
And there's still time to enter that competition as well, to win the Lotus Evora that you mentioned there as well, Doug. You know, I remember I was up at the British Touring Car Championship at Knockhill last year and got a chance to get a wee look and what have you. It's just it's a fantastic opportunity to get involved, support the initiative and, you know, win yourself a piece of motoring history.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to take the car around the circuit at Knockhill, 10 laps in the wet, 10 laps in the dry, different days, and it's a fantastic car to drive. But and that car, as I say, has been all over the country and raising money. And it is a unique car. You know, there only is one Clark car with the special Clark tartan in it as well. And it's chassis number 100,000. I've been fortunate enough, including today, I took Jim's original road-going Elan, which was chassis number one, up to the museum today and parked outside the museum. And we've been using that car recently, courtesy of Fiskins, Dougal Fiskin, and that's been a great asset to help us. And it's been a great comparison between the old Elan of 1962 and the new Evora now, you know. But this Evora will be won at the end of August, when Sir Jackie Stewart and Jim's sister, Isabel Henderson, come to Duns to officially open the museum, which will be sometime in the end of August, and someone will win that Evora.
And the great thing about the project in the new museum is that the support that we've had, not just in Scotland, but around the world, just speaks volumes of how highly regarded Jim is as well.
Well, you know, I think one of the highlights, you know, obviously was 1965 when he won both the World Championship Formula One and the Indianapolis 500 race, and he was the first non-American to win the Indianapolis 500 and to win the championship. You know, both the Formula One and that Indianapolis has never been repeated, and that was I think he became a real favourite, you know, in America. But you know, in the past they did this what they called the Tasman Series, which was races in Australia, New Zealand, and down under during the winter time. And so all around the world, he has been recognised as, you know, as one of a very modest and talented driver, and his legacy actually just seems to grow and grow. And a lot of people who actually never knew him or saw him race are fans today. And I ask him repeatedly, "Why are you a fan?" He said, "My father keeps talking about him so passionately," and I just liken it to somebody who's maybe a Man United fan. And the father was, and the son follows suit, and it's a bit like Jim. They just have this, you know, it's revered around the world, and it just goes on. And this museum today, there's so much interactive technology there, that, including simulators and new films, and all the trophies individually are electronically wired up so that you can actually learn and read and watch a film about each trophy, of how he won it, And there's lots of people like Andy Cowan, who's another, and Nisco Watson, who are both patrons locally, speaking about Jim, and some of Jim's friends who, in the early days, were involved in the local Berwick District Motor Club, you know, rallies at Charter Hall, Winfield, and places like that. All history, and a lot of people have learned a lot more about Jim than what they thought they knew in the past. So it's really, you know, you can go to the museum and spend a day there, and you still probably wouldn't see everything, and manage to listen and do everything that's on offer.
And Doug, what was life like growing up with Jim? And tell us a bit more about Jim Clark, the character.
Well, latterly in Jim's career, and you have to remember, Jim's career only spanned 10 years, from 1958 to 1968, in his motor racing world, really. And so it is a short spell when you look at it that way. It seemed a long time then. But I was actually living in Jim's house, farmhouse, because those trophies were there, and Jim was away racing abroad. And I had got married, and my mother was still alive in the farmhouse only 5 miles away. So Jim's parents asked me if I would just stay in Jim's house, which I did for a few years, actually, until after he was killed. And but Jim would come home occasionally, and we'd catch up with him then. But, see, Jim was a cousin. His mother and my father were brother and sister. And so at family events and things, we would catch up. But unfortunately, in his latter career, he was away an awful lot of the time, so we didn't get a chance to see him as much as we would have liked to. But he was just such a down-to-earth sort of fellow. And, because being a you know, a fan and obviously, you know, an idol of Jim's. All I wanted to know was about how to talk about cars and things. And Jim really wanted to come home and get away from all that and just talk about what was going on in the farm and everything like that. And people say he was shy, but I don't think he was shy. He could hold his own in conversations quite happily. He was modest. And really, he wasn't wanting to talk about his achievements. He just wanted to hear what else was going on. And he's just a normal guy, really.
And the one thing that impresses me about Jim is how versatile he was as a driver. You know, you mentioned winning Formula One, winning Indianapolis. I mean, he could turn his hand to anything and win, and that's something you just don't see in motorsport now.
Yep, I mean, Jim would have a sports car, a saloon car, you know, a Catina or whatever, or a Galaxy, and then a Formula 2 car or a Formula 1 car. And these days, Jim actually, all he wanted to do was literally was to drive cars, and he enjoyed driving, basically. And he wasn't, can I say it in a way, he wasn't in it for the money like today's sportsmen seem to be. And there wasn't the sponsorship then. I mean, Esso and Dunlop were the two names on his overalls, and that was about, and he drove for Lotus, and I'm led to believe that he never ever did have a contract with Lotus, because he started, you know, his career from the Border Rivers in Chernside and graduated with Ian Scott Watson into Lotus, and it just that kind of evolved with Colin Chapman, and it just became a partnership, and he obviously never changed. He did drive a little bit. He was going to drive for Aston Martin, but Lotus is who he drove for, really. But yes, he could in the early days, I suppose, the Border Rivers, he had some great training. He was driving Aston Martin DBR1s, Tajiri Jaguars, Lister Jaguars, you know, Porsche 356 cars and whatever, you know. And soon we'll be coming to the Bowness Hill Climb to the 60th anniversary, where he drove a Lotus Elite, a Porsche and Aston Martin, and that was only 3 weeks after he'd been at Le Mans with the Elite, and that's going to be repeated again later in the year. And that was what he loved doing, just driving cars. So I think, you know, the Grand Prix was just another part of his career, which he fitted into that, to his busy day. But nowadays, obviously, the Formula One drivers are not allowed to drive any other cars on a Grand Prix weekend.
And just finally, Doug, what do you think Jim would make of having a museum like this in his honour?
It's a question I get asked a lot, and I think Jim would say, well, what's all the fuss about and why are you doing all this? But the original museum was built because they didn't know what to do with the trophies, and they had to find a home for them, and the Dunsborough Council kindly said, look, we'll provide a room. It'll be a tourist attraction, but it'll also let everybody see what Jim achieved in his career. But Jim, you know, really didn't look for the limelight. He wasn't that way inclined, and he would be quietly proud to see it done, like his father and mother were, but, you know, his father and mother never approved of his racing at all. But I think he would have just accepted it, as he did. The only thing I remember he did enjoy was going round Chernside in a bus with his own people, his village of Chernside, who honoured him when he came home, and he enjoyed that. But the bigger picture of doing speeches and everything like that, that wasn't his scene, really.
Oh, absolutely great stuff. Thank you, Doug. Thanks very much for joining us on the show. It's great to chat all things Jim Clark with you, and we wish you every success with the new museum down there.
Well, I just, you know, all I would say is come down to the Borders, have a day in the Borders and just see the museum. It's fantastic. It's well worth a visit. And there's lots to do to see. So with simulators, interactive things going on, films, and more than what there was in the past. And it's well worth a visit.
Absolutely great stuff. All right, that's Doug Niven from the Jim Clark Trust there speaking to us on Rock Sport Radio. Now, we've got some rally action to look forward to over the next few days, with lots of big names taking to the stages of Rally Estonia. Now, it's classed as a World Rally promotional event, so all four manufacturers are bringing at least one top-tier car to the show. So let's find out more by speaking to rally expert David Halley, who joins us now. David, we've got over 100 entrants on the list for this one. Looks like it's going to be a cracker.
It's a complete cracker, yes. It's almost a world championship round, isn't it? It is a candidate event. It's they're looking to bring the world championship there, but they've obviously, with a certain world championship leader coming from the country, he's out there playing with his works Toyota, along with a lot of, as you say, the world championship crew are all out having a nosy, having a shot. Yeah, it's going to be a brilliant event.
And could you just explain, David, the importance of events like this for the World Rally drivers, given the break that we have between Sardinia and Finland?
Well, Estonia is not a million miles away from Finland, and the roads are very similar. So where we're going into Finland next, which are very fast gravel roads, they don't tend to have in the country. They don't have tarmac roads. They have these very hard, compacted gravel roads that everybody drives on, which is why the Finnish drivers in the past were so good on gravel, because they grew up, they lived on gravel. They didn't have much in the way of tarmac. Obviously, tarmac has come into Finland in recent years for the main roads, but the forests are still these hard gravel roads with yumps, natural yumps, not things that are made out of wood and metal and cause problems to cars. These are the real flying yumps that rallying is famous for. And the cars going over these phenomenal Estonia, similar sort of terrain. So it's match practice. And we always talk about seat time. We always talk about competence in the car. There's people in different cars. There's people having a go at different things. So, yeah, it's match practice.
And, of course, all eyes on home driver Ott Tänak. Won this event twice before. David, dare I say this comes at a good time for him as well, given what happened in Sardinia. He's had a couple of weeks to process that now, and he can get back behind the seat of that Yaris and show what he can do.
Exactly. The disappointment of not winning in Sardinia, having led and right up until the very end, just that silly mistake or breakage, whatever it was, either the breakage caused the accident or the accident caused the breakage. There was a problem at the end of the event, and he needs to get his head sorted out. But he's leading the championship, and he's going into his home event, which, as you say, he's won before. Then he's got Finland to come. This is about getting his head in the right place and also being able to show off his skills to his local people. He has a huge travelling support. You look at particularly any footage from Finland, and there are probably more Estonian flags than there are Finnish flags around in some places.
And David, this is also a good opportunity for Craig Breen and Paul Nagel to get to grips with that Hyundai i20 as well before Finland.
Exactly. Match practice. Craig's had a lot of match practice, but mainly in R5 cars over the last few months. He's driven a World Rally, an older World Rally Fiesta, but he has been keeping his hand in all year, just waiting for this opportunity, or an opportunity, and it turns out to be this opportunity. It's going to be perfect for him to get some seat time in the Hyundai World Rally car and get himself settled as to how he wants the car set up for Finland.
And just staying with Hyundai, they're also taking Andreas Mikkelsen along to this one. Goes into the event after a third place finish out in Sardinia last time out. I dare say he'll be hoping to use this as a springboard to go into the second half of the season and kind of kickstart his year in many respects as well, David.
Exactly. He has, as we all know, he had to give up his seat to Sebastian Loeb. We know Loeb was coming in to do the six events. He's done an extra event. Andreas had to sit that out. It's very difficult when you sit at the winter and you think you've got your year all sorted out, and then as the year approaches and the year begins, your year begins to crumble. So he needs to get his confidence back. He needs to get out there. He obviously did very well in Sardinia. He's on a high. Let's see if he can concentrate on getting that better and producing the results that Hyundai want him to do to win the Manufacturers' Championship.
Now, M-Sport have Elfyn Evans there, driving their Fiesta World Rally car, but they've said that this will be the first real test for the new Fiesta R5, because we've got Timo Suninen getting behind the wheel of that car. He'll be alongside his new co-driver, Jarmo Lehtinen, as well. How do you think they'll get on in the new Fiesta?
It's a different proposition to the World Rally car. It's obviously not got quite the same power, so he did very well in WRC2, which is with M Sport, which is where he got the promotion up into the world team, because he'd done so well in WRC2, winning that class in events throughout the world. So he knows that type of event, but he's had a couple of years in the world car, which is an entirely different animal. This new R5 is better than the previous Fiesta. Previous Fiesta R5, while still winning events, the design of that was 5 years old. Things have moved on in the world of rallying and engineering, so the new car is an entirely different concept, other than it complies with all the R5 rules. So, it'll be interesting to see how he goes against people like Olli Solberg out in the golf, the Polo R5 as well. So, there's going to be a strong R5 contingent going for it as well.
It's quite interesting because, you know, we were talking about Gus Greensmith making the jump from an R5 car to a World Rally car recently, but, you know, Timu's going the other way here. So how do you think he'll process those changes? You know, the pace notes will obviously be a little bit longer as well, and he's had so much seat time in a World Rally car over the last year or so as well.
The new R5 is not considerably less powerful than the World Car. It's a little bit heavier, so it reacts differently in the corners. It's still got enough power. It would still make your eyes water if you were to be sitting in it, I assure you. It's the aerodynamics that are not quite the same, so it doesn't fly in the same way as a World Car does. So that's where you have to be a little bit more careful when tackling the jumps. But I'm sure he'll manage just fine. He's a very skillful driver. He'll enjoy the fun, I'm sure.
David, I just want to get your thoughts on Esa Pekka Lappi. We've spoken about him in length and the challenges he's had making the switch to Citroën for this year. He'll be representing them in a World Rally car at this event. Do you think this is a good one, again, because Estonia is similar to Finland? It's one that will help him build a little bit of confidence with that car and again, just give him the belief that he can get some strong results out of it.
I think we know that car is incredibly difficult to drive. It needs somebody like Sebastian Ogier with his skill to keep that car on the straight and narrow. And Esa Pekka has struggled a bit with the car. This is, a perfect opportunity for him. The pressure is off. There's no desire to get it's not World Championship points at stake. So he can go into the event a little bit more relaxed, possibly, than on a World event. And he can go and have a play and learn the car and get used to that car, see if he can tune that car to how he wants it to perform when it comes to Finland in a couple of weeks' time.
Mm. Dave, just finally, is there anything else you think we should be keeping an eye on at this one?
This one, not particularly. What interested me this week was we had the Kenyan rally that took place last weekend as another candidate event for the World Championship. That's looking like that's going to happen on the World Championship next year. And the event was superbly presented by the organisers there. The security was brilliant. The marshals were absolutely superb. They had it's basically the military with big dods of wood. If you step out of line, you get asked once, you don't get asked a second time. You get a smack in the head from the dod of wood. So I wish we could do that sometimes in Europe. But the report's coming back. All the teams had representatives out in Kenya, and they've come back very, very positive about the event and looking forward to competing there next year.
Great stuff, David. Thank you very much, as always, for your time here on the show.
Not at all. We'll do it again. Thanks, gentlemen.
That's rally expert David Halley there.
Now let's find out the latest from the Scottish scene by getting the Superfast Scots Roundup with Glenn Alcock.
Hi guys, so I'm going to be a little bit different this week because I've not had much prep time, unfortunately, because I got back later this afternoon after being at the new Jim Clark Motorsport Museum. So obviously you've already talked to Doug Niven, and I had a good chat with Doug earlier on as well. There's an interview that I did with him on Superfast Scots on Facebook as well, so if you want to pop along and have a look at that. Basically, I'd just echo what he said, go and visit the museum. It's an incredible thing to go and see, and there's more in the area than just the museum. So, you know, if you want to do a Jim Clark kind of tour, you can go to the Eddington Mains Farm, where Jim used to, you know, do all his farming and where he grew up later in his life. Waterloo Arms Pub, so that he used to frequent there. You can get a pint of Racing Green, which I can recommend. They've got the Memorial Clock in Chernside, so you can go and have a look at that as well. And it's got a new kind of plaque for the 50th anniversary that went up. You can also obviously pay your respects at the church in Chernside as well. The roads in the area make you realise why he was such a good racing driver as well, because they're quite good fun to drive. It's a beautiful part of the country, and I definitely recommend going along. So the Motorsport Museum itself, so as Doug said, 7 years in the making, and it's reopened after 15 months. The former Jim Clark Room, you know, it was a great place to go and visit, but it was essentially just a trophy display, you know, a very small kind of area. And it was opened in 1969. So obviously Jim was champion in F1 in 1963 and 1965, and he won at the Indy 500 in 1965, and unfortunately died in that Formula 2 race in Hockenheim on April the 7th, 1968, aged only 32. and born in Kilmarny, Fife. So if you pop there, there's a statue of him as well that you can visit, although then he obviously moved to the Borders. In the museum, so the car's on display. Doug's already talked about it. The one that was loaned by Dario is the Lotus Cortina from 1964, which won the British Saloon Car Championship, this forerunner to the British Touring Car Championship, and also the Lotus 25, which is on loan from Basel in Switzerland. It's the first time the car's been in the UK for over 50 years, and it raced in 10 Grand Prix covering 1963, 1964, 1965. The trophy display, it was probably the bit I enjoyed the most. You know, I was in Maranello recently, and that was the bit that got me there as well. But there was 135 trophies on display at the new museum for Jim. And there's interactive tablets that you know give you a little bit of information about the trophy, the races that he won it, the car that he was driving at the time. There's video footage and pictures. It's really, you know, moved into like a new era. Really, really good. Really impressed with that. The cars that are on display, so the plan is to, you know, change them regularly. So that'll want to bring you back. I've got to say the prices are great. So the tickets were £5 for an adult entry fee. And once you've paid that, then you can go back during the year. So if they change the cars, you can go back and see different ones. So I'll definitely be popping back. If the Lotus 38 turns up, I'd like to go and see that. The simulator was good fun as well. I had a wee go in that. But just to talk about some of Jim's stats, so obviously this weekend you've got the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, and Lewis Hamilton's kind of on the brink of being able to beat one of Jim's records that stood for over 50 years, which is the five wins at the British Grand Prix. So Jim, 73 race starts he had, 25 wins. So if you compare that with Lewis Hamilton, right, so Lewis Hamilton's win rate is 34.7%, and Jim's is 34.7%. Hamilton is only 33.2%. So in actual fact, you know, you think of Lewis as being extremely dominant, but that's the situation there. So what's more impressive as well is that Lewis has only had 23 retirements in his career from 238 starts, and Jim had 24, but from only 72. So, you know, really, really impressive stats. 33 pole positions from 72 starts as well. So, I mean, what he accomplished back in the day was really something special.
And Glenn, just finally, the fantastic work you do with Superfast Scots is all about, you know, promoting and supporting Scottish motor racing talent. How important do you think this museum will be to help inspire the next generation of young drivers in Scotland?
Well, today, I mean, we've talked about the likes of Gordy Much in the past. So he's just come back from Belgium, where he had three pole positions. He was there, three podiums. And he was there today. He also had Jamie Thorburn, who races in Formula Ford nationally at the moment, from the Border Reavers. So these are quite young guys, you know, but they still look up to Jim and realise what he accomplished. I mean, that's the thing, you know, comparing him there with Lewis Hamilton. You think about he's Scottish, he achieved so much, and as we've already mentioned, you know, he jumped into loads and loads of different cars. You know, you could, if Lewis beats some of Michael's, records, for example, you could say, like, statistically, he's the greatest Formula One driver that there's ever been. But Jim is probably one of the greatest racing drivers there's ever been, because he was able to you know, be quick in whatever he was driving. So, two Formula One World Championships doesn't really, you know, do justice to the talent that he had. But I think this will serve as an inspiration. And when you go there now, it's got that new feel about it. You know, it's a much more fresh look, and the way that you've got the interactivity of it, I think it'll appeal to people that are younger. So I can see it as being, you know, it's a massive positive step for Scotland.
Absolutely. And thank you very much, as always, for your time here on Pole Position.
No problem, thank you.
That's the Superfast Scots roundup there with Glenn Alcott. All right, now it's time for a little bit of this.
Final lap on Pole Position on Rock Sport Radio.
It's that time of the show, Adam, as you tell us six stories from the world of motorsport this week in just 60 seconds. So, second one of July, Adam, you got last week off to a flyer, you made it look pretty easy, yeah, actually.
Comfortable victory.
So, let's see how you get on this time round, as your time starts now.
Paul de Resta says he's keen on a move to the new hypercar project in the World Endurance Championship. Aston Martin will run two factory cars in the hypercar category in two seasons' time. Patrick Campbell's son, Adrian, will make his prototype debut in the European Le Mans Series in Barcelona later this month. He'll be driving into Europol's Ligier LMP2 car at the four-hour event. Moto2 rider Brad Binder will be in MotoGP next year after signing a one-year deal with KTM. He's joining the Satellite Tech 3 team alongside Miguel Oliveira. Formula E now and Audi have said that Daniel Abt and Lucas Degrassi will stay with them next season. They're second in the team standings as we go into the doubleheader finale in New York City this weekend. Dorian Boklolaki will be back in a Formula 2 car this weekend with Trident. He started the year with Campos Racing but ran out of funds after the Paul Ricard round. And finally, more bad news for Rich Energy after an allegedly rogue employee sent out a tweet claiming they had ended their sponsorship of the Haas F1 team. The shareholders said they want to stay in the sport and are in the process of legally removing the individual responsible for the tweet from all extensive executive responsibilities, but William Story says that won't happen. Poor strategy this evening.
Well, and a baffling story to end as well, Adam. You know, Stuart Codlin was chatting about it there at the top of the show, but yeah.
I'm done with it. You know, it's just, honestly, it's pathetic. It really is. You know, it's. What is there more to say about it? It's an absolute farce. It really is.
I tell you the one
farcical.
One thing I will say, if they had just kept their head down at the start of this year, I think people would have let it slide. It's the fact they've came in and tried to be edgy like Red Bull. Remember when Red Bull came into to Formula 1, they weren't particularly liked by certainly the old guard of Formula 1. Rich Energy have kind of came in with that swagger and there's not really anything to back it up, unfortunately, yeah. You know, and yeah.
I mean, one thing you can say is they've certainly had a lot of publicity and there's that old saying, you know, all publicity is good publicity. So I think certainly a lot more people know about Rich Energy than would have done previously. So perhaps from that perspective it might have been a good thing for them, but it's farcical.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to sum up as well. And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for on Pole Position this week. But we'll be back for next Thursday night to do it all again. My thanks to Adam, to our guests, and to you for joining us as well. Stay tuned for The Rock Zone coming up next on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.